and gazed up one more time at the sky. Then, as if he had made up his mind, he clambered down the steps of the slide. He left the park and walked off in the direction of the station. Shadowing him wasn't particularly hard. There were few people on a residential street on a Sunday night, and even keeping her distance, she wouldn't lose him. He also had not the slightest suspicion that someone was observing him. He never looked back, kept walking at a set pace, the pace people keep when they're preoccupied. How ironic, Almame thought. The pursuer's blind spot is that he never thinks he's being pursued. After a while, it dawned on her that Bobblehead wasn't heading toward Koenji Station. Back in the apartment, using a Tokyo map of all 23 wards, she had gone over the district again and again until she had memorized the local geography so she would know what direction to take in an emergency. So though he was initially headed toward the station, she knew that when he turned at one corner, he was going in a different direction. Bobblehead didn't know the neighborhood, she noticed. Twice he stopped at a corner, looked around as if unsure where to go, and checked the address plaques on telephone poles. He was definitely not from around here. Finally, Bobblehead picked up the pace. Almame surmised that he was back on familiar territory. He walked past a municipal elementary school, down a narrow street, and went inside an old three-story apartment building. Almame waited for 5 minutes after the man had disappeared inside. Bumping into him at the entrance was the last thing she wanted. There were concrete eaves at the entrance, a round light bathing the front door in a yellowish glow. She looked everywhere, but couldn't find a sign for the name of the building. Maybe the apartment building didn't have a name. Either way, it had been built quite a few years ago. She memorized the address indicated on the nearby telephone pole. After 5 minutes, she headed toward the entrance. She passed quickly under the yellowish light and hurriedly opened the door. There was no one in the tiny entrance hall. It was an empty space, devoid of warmth. A fluorescent light on its last legs buzzed above her. The sound of a TV filtered in from somewhere, as did the shrill voice of a child pestering his mother. Almame took her apartment key out of the pocket of her down jacket and lightly jiggled it in her hands so if anyone saw her, it would look like she lived in the building. She scanned the names on the mailboxes. One of them might be Bobblehead's. She wasn't hopeful, but thought it worth trying. It was a small building with not that many residents. When she ran across the name Kawana on one of the boxes, all sound faded away. She stood frozen in front of that mailbox. The air felt terribly thin, and she found it hard to breathe. Her lips, slightly parted, were trembling. Time passed. She knew how stupid and dangerous this was. Bobblehead could show up any minute. Still, she couldn't tear herself away from the mailbox. One little card with the name Kawana had paralyzed her brain, frozen her body in place. She had no positive proof that this resident named Kawana was Tengo Kawana. Kawana wasn't that common a name, but certainly not as unusual as Almame. But if, as she surmised, Bobblehead had some connection with Tengo, then there was a strong possibility that this Kawana was none other than Tengo Kawana. The room number was 303, coincidentally the same number as the apartment where she was currently staying. What should I do? Almame bit down hard on her lip. Her mind kept going in circles and couldn't find an exit. What should I do? Well, she couldn't stay planted in front of the mailbox forever. She made up her mind and walked up the uninviting concrete stairs to the third floor. Here and there on the gloomy floor were thin cracks from years of wear and tear. Her sneakers made a grating noise as she walked. Ah-mama now stood outside apartment 303. An ordinary steel door with the printed card saying Kawana in the name slot. Just the last name. Those two characters looked brusque, inorganic. At the same time, a deep riddle lay within them. Ah-mama stood there, listening carefully, her senses razor sharp. But she couldn't hear any sound at all from behind the door, or even tell if there was a light on inside. There was a doorbell next to the door. Ah-mama was confused. She bit her lip and contemplated her next step. "Am I supposed to ring the bell?" she asked herself. Or was this some clever trap? Maybe Bobblehead was hiding behind the door, like an evil dwarf in a dark forest, an ominous smile on his face as he waited. "He deliberately revealed himself on top of that slide to lure me over here and take me captive. Fully aware that I'm searching for Tengo, he's using that as bait. A low-down, cunning man who knows exactly what my weak point is. That's the only way he could ever get me to open my door from the inside." She checked that no one else was around and pulled the pistol out of her jeans. She flicked off the safety and stuffed the pistol into the pocket of her down jacket so she could get to it easily. She gripped the pistol in her right hand, finger on the trigger, and with her left hand, pressed the doorbell. The doorbell rang inside the apartment, a leisurely chime out of step with her racing heart. She gripped the pistol tight, waiting for the door to open. But it didn't. And there didn't seem to be anyone peering out at her through the peephole. She waited a moment, then rang the bell again. The bell was loud enough to get all the people in Suginami Ward to raise their heads and prick up their ears. Amama's right hand on the pistol grip started to sweat a little, but there was no response. "Better leave," she decided. "The Kawana who lives in 303, whoever he is, isn't at home, and that ominous bobblehead is still lurking somewhere in this building. Too dangerous to stay any longer." She rushed down the stairs, shooting a glance at the mailbox as she passed, and left the building. Head down, she hurried under the yellow light and headed toward the street. She glanced back to make sure no one was following her. There were lots of things she needed to think about, and an equal number of decisions she had to make. She felt in her pocket and reset the safety on the pistol. Then, away from any possible prying eyes, she shoved the pistol in the back of her jeans. "I can't get my expectations or hopes up too high," she told herself. "The Kawana who lived there might be Tengo. And then again, he might not. Once you get your hopes up, your mind starts acting on its own. And when your hopes are dashed, you get disappointed. And disappointment leads to a feeling of helplessness. You get careless and let your guard down. And right now," she thought, "that's the last thing I can afford. I have no idea how much Bobblehead knows, but the reality is that he's getting close to me, almost close enough to reach out and touch. I need to pull myself together and stay alert. I'm dealing with someone who is totally dangerous. The tiniest mistake could be fatal. First of all, I have to stay away from that old apartment building. He's hiding in there, scheming how to capture me. Like a poisonous, blood-sucking spider who has spun a web in the darkness." By the time she got back to her apartment, Ah-mama's mind was made up. There was but one path she could follow. This time she dialed Tamaru's entire number. She let it ring 12 times. Then hung up. She took off her cap and coat, returned the pistol to the drawer, then gulped down 2 glasses of water. She filled the kettle and boiled water for tea. She peeked through a gap in the curtain at the park across the street to make sure no one was there. She stood in front of the bathroom mirror and brushed her hair. Even after that, her fingers didn't work right. The tension remained. She was pouring hot water in the teapot when the phone rang. It was Tamaru, of course.
"I just saw Bobblehead," she told him.
Silence.
"By just saw him, you mean he's not there anymore?"
"That's right," Al Mama said. "A little while ago he was in the park across from my building, but he's not there anymore."
"How long ago do you mean by a little while ago?"
"About 40 minutes."
"Why didn't you call me 40 minutes ago?"
"I had to follow him right away and didn't have the time."
Tamaru exhaled ever so slowly, as if squeezing out the breath.
"Follow him?"
"I didn't want to lose him."
"I thought I told you never to go outside."
Al-Mama chose her words carefully. "But I can't just sit by when danger's approaching me. Even if I had called you, you wouldn't have been able to get here right away, right?"
Tamaru made a small sound in the back of his throat. "So you followed Bobblehead."
It looks like he had no idea at all he was being followed.
"A pro can act like that," Tamaru cautioned.
Tamaru was right. It all might have been an elaborate ruse. Not that she would admit that. "I'm sure you would be able to do that. But as far as I could tell, Bobblehead isn't on the same level. He may be skilled, but he's different from you."
"He might have had backup."
"No, he was definitely on his own." Tamaru paused for a moment.
"All right. So did you find out where he was heading?"
Al-Mama told him the address of the building and described its exterior. She didn't know which apartment he was in. Tamaru took notes. He asked a few questions, and Al-Mama answered as accurately as she could.
"You said that when you first saw him, he was in the park across the street from you," Tamaru said.
"Correct."
"What was he doing there?"
Al-Mama told him how the man was sitting on top of the slide and staring at the night sky. She didn't mention the two moons. That was only to be expected.
"Looking at the sky?"
Tamaru asked. Al-Mama could hear the gears shift in his mind. "The sky, or the moon, or the stars, one of those."
"And he let himself be exposed like that, defenseless, on the slide?"
"That's right."
"Don't you find that odd?"
Tamaru asked. His voice was hard and dry, reminding her of a desert plant that could survive a whole year on one day's worth of rain.
"That man had run you down. He was one step away from you."
"Pretty impressive."
"Yet there he was on top of a slide, leisurely gazing up at the night sky, not paying any attention to the apartment where you live." "It doesn't add up."
"I agree. It doesn't make much sense. Be that as it may, I couldn't very well let him go."
Tamaru sighed.
"But I still think it was dangerous."
Al-Mama didn't say anything.
"Did following him help you get any closer to solving the riddle?"
Tamaru asked.
"No," Al-Mama said. "But there was one thing that caught my attention."
"Which was?"
"When I looked at the mailboxes, I saw that a person named Kawana lives on the third floor."
"So?"
"Have you heard of Air Chrysalis, the best-selling novel this past summer?"
"Even I read newspapers, you know. The author, Eriko Fukada, was a daughter of a follower of Sakigake. She disappeared and they suspected she was abducted by the cult. The police investigated it. I haven't read the novel yet."
"Eriko Fukada isn't just the daughter of a follower. Her father was leader, the head of Sakigake. She's the daughter of the man I sent to the other side."
Tengo Kawana was hired by the editor as a ghostwriter and rewrote Air Chrysalis. In reality, the novel is a joint work between the two of them. A long silence descended, long enough to walk to the end of a long, narrow room, look up something in a dictionary, and walk back. Finally, Tamaru broke the silence.
"You have no proof that the Kawana who lives in that building is Tengo Kawana."
"Not yet, no," Amame admitted. "But if he is the same person, then this all makes sense."
"Certain parts do mesh together," Tamaru said. "But how do you know that this Tengo Kawana ghost wrote Air Chrysalis? That can't have been made public. It would have caused a major scandal."
"I heard it from Leader himself. Right before he died, he told me." Tamaru's voice turned a little cold.
"Don't you think you should have told me this before?"
"At the time, I didn't think it was so important." There was silence again for a time. Amame couldn't tell what Tamaru was thinking, but she knew he didn't like excuses.
"Okay," he finally said. "We'll put that on hold. Let's cut to the chase. What you're trying to say is that Bobblehead marked this Tengo Kawana, and using that as a lead, he was tracking down your whereabouts."
"That's what I think."
"I don't get it," Tamaru said. "Why would Tengo Kawana be a lead to find you? There isn't any connection between you and Kawana, is there? Other than that you dealt with Eriko Fukada's father, and Tengo was a ghostwriter for her novel."
"There is a connection," Amame said, her voice flat.
"There's a direct relationship between you and Tengo Kawana. Is that what you're saying?"
"He and I were in the same class in elementary school, and I believe he's the father of my baby. But I can't explain any more beyond that. It's very, how should I put it, personal." On the other end of the phone, she heard a ballpoint pen tapping on a desk. That was the only sound she could hear.
"Personal,"
Tamaru repeated, in a voice that sounded like he had spied some weird creature on top of a rock in a garden.
"I'm sorry," Amame said.
"I understand. It's a very personal thing. I won't ask any more," Tamaru said. "So, specifically, what do you want from me?"
"Well, the first thing I would like to know is if the Kawana who lives in that building is actually Tengo Kawana. If it were possible, I would like to make sure of that myself, but it's too risky to go there again."
"Agreed."
"And Bobblehead is probably holed up somewhere in that building, planning something. If he's getting close to locating me, we have to do something about it."
"He already knows a certain amount about the connection between you and the Dowager. He has painstakingly hauled in these various leads and is trying to tie them all together. We can't ignore him."
"I have one other request of you," Amame said.
"Go ahead."
"If it is really Tengo Kawana living there, I don't want any harm to come to him. If it's unavoidable that he is going to get hurt, then I want to take his place." Tamaru was silent again for a time. No more ballpoint pen tapping this time. There were no sounds at all, in fact. He was considering things in a world devoid of sound.
"I think I can take care of the first two requests," Tamaru said. "That's part of my job. But I can't say anything about the third. It involves very personal things, and there's too much about it I don't understand. Speaking from experience, taking care of three items at once isn't easy. Like it or not, you end up prioritizing."
"I don't mind. You can prioritize them however you like. I just want you to keep this in mind. While I'm still alive, I have to meet Tengo.
There's something I have to tell him.
I'll keep it in mind,
Tamaru said.
While there's still spare room in my mind, that is.
Thank you.
I have to report what you have told me to the Dowager. This is a rather delicate issue, and I can't decide things on my own. So I'll hang up for now. Listen, do not go outside anymore. Lock the door and stay put. If you go outside, it could cause problems. Maybe it already has.
But it helped me find out a few things about him.
All right,
Tamaru said, sounding resigned.
From what you have told me, it sounds like you did an excellent job. I'll admit that. But don't let your guard down. We don't know yet what he's got up his sleeve, and considering the situation, most likely he has an organization behind him. Do you still have the thing I gave you?
Of course.
Best to keep it nearby.
Will do. A short pause, then the phone connection went dead. Amame sank back into the bathtub, which she had filled to the brim, and while she warmed up, she thought about Tengo. The Tengo who might or might not be living in an apartment in that old building. She pictured the uninviting steel door, the slot for the name card, the name Kawana printed on the card. What kind of place was behind that door? And what kind of life was he living? In the hot water, she touched her breasts, rubbing them. Her nipples had grown larger and harder than before, and more sensitive. I wish these were Tengo's hands instead of mine, she thought. She imagined his hands large and warm, strong, but surely gentle. If her breasts were enveloped in his hands, how much joy and peace she would feel. Almame also noticed that her breasts were now slightly larger. It was no illusion. They definitely were swollen, the curve softer. It's probably due to my pregnancy. Or maybe they just got bigger, unrelated to being pregnant. One aspect of my transformation. She put her hands on her abdomen. It was still barely swollen, and she didn't have any morning sickness for some reason. But there was a little one hidden within. She knew it. Wait a moment, she thought. Maybe they're not after my life, but after this little one. As revenge for me killing Leader, are they trying to get to it, along with me? The thought made her shudder. Amame was doubly determined now to see Tengo. Together, the two of them had to protect the little one. I have had so many precious things stolen from me in my life, but this is one I am going to hold on to. She went to bed and read for a while, but sleep didn't come. She shut her book and gently rolled into a ball to protect her abdomen. With her cheek against the pillow, she thought of the winter moon in the sky above the park, and the little green moon beside it. Maza and Dota. The mixed light of the two moons bathing the bare branches of the Zelkova tree. At this very moment, Tamaru must be figuring out a plan, his mind racing at top speed. She could see him, brows knit, tip of his ballpoint pen tapping furiously on the desktop. Eventually, as if led by that monotonous, ceaseless rhythm, the soft blanket of sleep wrapped itself around her.
Chapter 21. Tengo. Somewhere inside his head. The phone was ringing. The hands on his alarm clock showed 2:04. Monday, 2:04 a.m. It was still dark out, and Tengo had been sound asleep. A peaceful, dreamless sleep. First, he thought it was Fukaeri. She would be the only person who would possibly call at this ungodly hour. Or it could be Komatsu. Komatsu didn't have much common sense when it came to time. but somehow the ring didn't sound like Komatsu. It was more insistent and businesslike. And besides, he had just seen Komatsu a few hours earlier. One option was to ignore the call and go back to sleep, Tengo's first choice. But the phone kept on ringing. It might go on ringing all night, for that matter. He got out of bed, bumping his shin as he did, and picked up the receiver. "Hello," Tengo said, his voice still slurry from sleep. It was like his head was filled with frozen lettuce. There must be some people who don't know you're not supposed to freeze lettuce. Once lettuce has been frozen, it loses all its crispness, which for lettuce is surely its best characteristic. When he held the receiver to his ear, he heard the sound of wind blowing, a capricious wind rushing through a narrow alley, ruffling the fur of beautiful deer bent over to drink from a clear stream. But it wasn't the sound of wind. It was someone's breathing, amplified by the phone. "Hello," Tengo repeated. Was it a prank call? Or perhaps the connection was bad? "Hello," the person on the other end said. A woman's voice he had heard before. It wasn't Fuka Eri, nor was it his older girlfriend. "Hello," Tengo said. "Koana here." "Tengo," the person said. They were finally on the same page, though he still didn't know who it was. "Who's calling?" "Kumi Adachi," the woman said. "Oh, hi," Tengo said. Kumi Adachi, the young nurse who lived in the apartment with the hooting owl. "What's going on?" "Were you asleep?" "Yes," Tengo said. "How about you?" This was a pointless question. People who are sleeping can't make phone calls. Why did I say such a stupid thing, he wondered. It must be the frozen lettuce in my head. "I'm on duty now," she said. She cleared her throat. "Mr. Kawana just passed away." "Mr. Kawana just passed away," Tengo repeated, not comprehending. Was someone telling him he himself had just died? "Your father just breathed his last breath," Kumi said, rephrasing. Tengo pointlessly switched the receiver from his right hand to his left. "Breathed his last breath," he repeated. "I was dozing in the nurse's lounge when the bell rang, just after one. It was the bell for your father's room. He has been in a coma for so long, and he couldn't ring the bell by himself, so I thought it was odd, and went to check it out. When I got there, his breathing had stopped, as had his heart. I woke up the on-call doctor, and we tried to revive him, but couldn't." "Are you saying my father pressed the call button?" "Probably. There was no one else who could have." "What was the cause of death?" Tengo asked. "I really can't say, though he didn't seem to have suffered. His face looked very peaceful. It was like a windless day at the end of autumn when a single leaf falls from a tree. But maybe that's not a good way to put it." "No, that's okay," Tengo said. "That's a good way of putting it. Tengo, can you get here today?" "I think so." His classes at the cram school began again today, Monday, but for something like this, he would be able to get out of them. "I'll take the first express train. I should be there before 10. I would appreciate it if you would. There are all sorts of formalities that have to be taken care of." "Formalities," Tengo said. "Is there anything in particular I should bring with me?" "Are you Mr. Kawana's only relative?" "I'm pretty sure I am." "Then bring your registered seal. You might need it. And do you have a certificate of registration for the seal?" "I think I have a spare copy." "Bring that, too, just in case. I don't think there's anything else you especially need. Your father arranged everything beforehand."
"Arranged everything?"
While he was still conscious. He gave detailed instructions for everything. The money for his funeral, the clothes he would wear in the coffin, where his ashes would be interred. He was very thorough when it came to preparations. Very practical, I guess you could say."
"That's the kind of person he was," Tengo said, rubbing his temple.
"I finish my rotation at 7 a.m., and then I'm going home to sleep. But Nurse Tamura and Nurse Omura will be on duty in the morning, and they can explain the details to you."
"Thank you for all you've done," Tengo said.
"You're quite welcome,"
Kumi Adachi replied.
And then, as if suddenly remembering, her tone turned formal. "My deepest sympathy for your loss."
"Thank you," Tengo said. He knew he couldn't go back to sleep, so he boiled water and made coffee. That woke him up a bit. Feeling hungry, he threw together a sandwich of tomatoes and cheese that were in the fridge. Like eating in the dark, he could feel the texture, but very little of the flavor. He then took out the train schedule and checked the time for the next express to Tateyama. He had only returned 2 days earlier from the cat town, on Saturday afternoon, and now here he was, setting off again. This time, though, he would probably only stay a night or two. At 4 a.m. he washed his face in the bathroom and shaved. He used a brush to tame his cowlicks, but, as always, was only partly successful. Let it be, he thought. It will fall into place before long. His father's passing didn't particularly shock Tengo. He had spent 2 solid weeks beside his unconscious father. He already felt that his father had accepted his impending death. The doctors weren't able to determine what had put him into a coma, but Tengo knew. His father had simply decided to die, or else had abandoned the will to live any longer. To borrow Kumi's phrase, as a single leaf on a tree, he turned off the light of consciousness, closed the door on any senses, and waited for the change of seasons. From Chikura Station, he took a taxi and arrived at the Seaside Sanatorium at 10:30. Like the previous day, Sunday, it was a calm early winter day. Warm sunlight streamed down on the withered lawn as if rewarding it, and a calico cat that Tengo had never seen before was sunning itself, leisurely grooming its tail. Nurse Tamura and Nurse Omura came to the entrance to greet him. Quietly, they each expressed their condolences, and Tengo thanked them. His father's body was being kept in an inconspicuous little room in an inconspicuous corner of the sanatorium. Nurse Tamura led Tengo there. His father was lying face up on a gurney, covered in a white cloth. In the square, windowless room, the white fluorescent light overhead made the white walls even brighter. On top of a waist-high cabinet was a glass vase with 3 white chrysanthemums, probably placed there that very morning. On the wall was a round clock. It was an old, dusty clock, but it told the time correctly. Its role, perhaps, was to be a witness of some kind. Besides this, there were no furniture or decorations. Countless bodies of elderly people must have passed through here, entering without a word, exiting without a word. A straightforward but solemn atmosphere lay over the room, like an unspoken fact. His father's face didn't look much different from when he was alive. Even up close, it didn't seem like he was dead. His color wasn't bad, and perhaps because someone had been kind enough to shave him, his chin and upper lip were strangely smooth. There didn't seem to be all that much difference from when he was alive, deeply asleep, except that now the feeding tubes and catheters were unnecessary. Leave the body like this, though, and in a few days decay would set in, and then there would be a big difference between life and death. But the body would be cremated before that happened. The doctor with whom Tengo had spoken many times before came in, expressed his sympathy, then explained what had led up to his father's passing. He was very kind, very thorough in his explanation, but it really all came down to one conclusion. The cause of death was unknown. None of their tests had ever determined what was wrong with him. The closest the doctor could say was that Tengo's father died of old age, but he was still only in his mid-60s, too young for such a diagnosis. As the attending physician, I'm the one who fills out the death certificate, the doctor said hesitantly. I'm thinking of writing that the cause of death was heart failure brought on by an extended coma, if that is all right with you. But actually the cause of death was not heart failure brought on by an extended coma? Is that what you're saying? The doctor looked a bit embarrassed. True. Until the very end, we found nothing wrong with his heart. But you couldn't find anything wrong with any of his other organs. That's right, the doctor said reluctantly. But the form requires a clear cause of death. Correct. This isn't my field, but right now his heart is stopped, right? Of course, his heart is stopped. Which is a kind of organ failure, isn't it? The doctor considered this. If the heart beating is considered normal, then yes, it is a sort of organ failure, as you say. So, please write it that way. Heart failure brought on by an extended coma, was it? I have no objection. The doctor seemed relieved. I can have the death certificate ready in 30 minutes, he said. Tengo thanked him. The doctor left, leaving only bespectacled Nurse Tamura behind. Shall I leave you alone with your father? Nurse Tamura asked Tengo. Since she had to ask, it was standard procedure. The question sounded a bit matter-of-fact.
No, there's no need, thanks, Tengo said. Even if he were left alone with his father, there was nothing in particular he wanted to say to him. It was the same as when he was alive. Now that he was dead, there weren't suddenly all sorts of topics Tengo wanted to discuss. Would you like to go somewhere else, then, to discuss the arrangements? You don't mind? Nurse Tamura asked. I don't mind, Tengo replied. Before Nurse Tamura left, she faced the corpse and brought her hands together in prayer. Tengo did the same. People naturally pay their respects to the dead. The person had, after all, just accomplished the personal, profound feat of dying. Then the two of them left the windowless little room and went to the cafeteria. There was no one else there. Bright sunlight shone in through the large window facing the garden. Tengo stepped into that light and breathed a sigh of relief. There was no sign of the dead there. This was the world of the living, no matter how uncertain and imperfect a world it might be. Nurse Tamura poured hot-roasted hojicha tea into a teacup and passed it to him. They sat down across from each other and drank their tea in silence for a while. "Are you staying over somewhere tonight?" Nurse Tamura asked. "I'm planning to stay over, but I haven't made a reservation yet." "If you don't mind, why don't you stay in your father's room? Nobody's using it, and you can save on hotel costs, if it doesn't bother you." "It doesn't bother me," Tengo said, a little surprised. "But is it all right to do that?" "We don't mind. If you're okay with it, it's okay with us. I'll get the bed ready later." "So," Tengo said, broaching the topic, "what am I supposed to do now?" "Once you get the death certificate from the attending physician, go to the town office and get a permit for cremation, and then take care of the procedures to remove his name from the family record. Those are the main things you need to do now. There should be other things you'll need to take care of, his pension, changing names on his savings account, but talk to the lawyer about those." "Lawyer?" This took Tengo by surprise. "Mr. Kawana, your father, that is, spoke with a lawyer about the procedures for after his death. Don't let the word lawyer scare you. Our facility has a lot of elderly patients, and since many are not legally competent, we have paired up with a local law office to provide consultations, so people can avoid legal problems related to division of estates. They also make up wills and provide witnesses. They don't charge a lot." "Did my father have a will?" "I can't really say anything about it. You'll need to talk to the lawyer."
"I see. Can I see him soon?"
"We got in touch with him, and he'll be coming here at 3. Is that all right? It seems like we're rushing things, but I know you're busy, so I hope you don't mind that we went ahead."
"I appreciate it."
Tengo was thankful for her efficiency. For some reason, all the middle-aged women he knew were very efficient. "Before that, though, make sure you go to the town office," Nurse Tamura said. "Get his name removed from your family record, and get a permit for cremation. Nothing can happen until you've done that."
"Well, then I have to go to Ichikawa. My father's permanent legal residence should be Ichikawa. If I do that, though, I won't be able to make it back by 3.
The nurse shook her head.
"No, soon after he came here, your father changed his official residence from Ichikawa to Chikura. He said it should make things easier if and when the time came."
"He was well prepared," Tengo said, impressed. It was as if he knew from the beginning that this was where he would die.
"He was," the nurse agreed. "No one else has ever done that. Everyone thinks they will just be here for a short time. Still, though," she began to say, and stopped, quietly bringing her hands together in front of her to suggest the rest of what she was going to say. "At any rate, you don't need to go to Ichikawa."
Tengo was taken to his father's room, the room where he spent his final months. The sheets and covers had been stripped off, leaving only a striped mattress. There was a simple lamp on the nightstand, and 5 empty hangers in the narrow closet. There wasn't a single book in the bookshelf, and all his personal effects had been taken away. But Tengo couldn't recall what personal effects had been there in the first place. He put his bag on the floor and looked around. The room still had a medicinal smell, and you could still detect the breath of a sick person hanging in the air. Tengo opened the window to let in fresh air. The sun-bleached curtain fluttered in the breeze, like the skirt of a girl at play.
"How wonderful it would be if Aomami were here," he thought, "just holding my hand tight, not saying a word."
He took a bus to the Chikura town hall, showed them the death certificate, and received a permit for cremation. Once 24 hours had passed since the time of death, the body could be cremated. He also applied to have his father's name removed from the family record, and received a certificate to that effect. The procedures took a while, but were almost disappointingly simple. Nothing that would cause any soul-searching. It was no different from reporting a stolen car. Nurse Tamura used their office copier to make 3 copies of the documents he received.
At 2:30, before the lawyer comes, someone will be here from Zenkosha, a funeral parlor, Mrs. Tamura said. Please give him 1 copy of the cremation permit. The person from the funeral parlor will take care of the rest. While he was still alive, your father talked to the funeral director and decided on all the arrangements. He also put enough money aside to cover it, so you don't need to do anything. Unless you have an objection.
No, no objection, Tango said. His father had left hardly any belongings behind. Old clothes, a few books. That was all.
Would you like something as a keepsake?
All there is, though, is an alarm clock radio, an old self-winding watch, and reading glasses, Nurse Tamura said. I don't want anything, Tango told her. Just dispose of it any way you like. At precisely 2:30, the funeral director arrived, dressed in a black suit. He moved silently. A thin man in his early 50s, he had long fingers, large eyes, and a single dry black wart next to his nose. He seemed to have spent a great deal of time outdoors, because his face was suntanned all over, down to the tips of his ears. Tengo wasn't sure why, but he had never seen a fat funeral director. The man explained the main procedures for the funeral. He was very polite and spoke slowly, deliberately, as if indicating that they could take all the time they needed.
While your father was alive, he said he wanted as simple a funeral as possible. He wanted a simple, functional casket, and he wanted to be cremated as is. He did not want any ceremony, no scriptures read, no posthumous Buddhist name, or flowers, or a eulogy. And he didn't want a grave. He instructed me to have his ashes simply put in a suitable communal facility. That is, if there are no objections.
He paused and looked entreatingly at Tengo with his large eyes.
If that is what my father wanted, then I have no objection, Tengo said, looking straight back at those eyes.
The funeral director nodded and cast his eyes down.
Today would be the wake, and for 1 night we will have the body lie in state in our funeral home. So we will need to transport the body to our place. The cremation will take place tomorrow at 1:30 in the afternoon in the crematorium nearby. I hope this is satisfactory.
I have no objection.
Will you be attending the cremation?
I will, Tengo said.
There are some who do not like to attend, and it is entirely up to you.
I will be there, Tengo said.
Very good, the man said, sounding a little relieved. I'm sorry to bother you with this now, but this is the same amount I showed your father while he was still alive. I would appreciate it if you would approve it.
The funeral director, his long fingers like insect legs, extracted a statement from a folder and passed it to Tengo. Tengo knew almost nothing about funerals, but he could see this was quite inexpensive. He had no objection. He borrowed a ballpoint pen and signed the agreement. The lawyer came just before 3, and he and the funeral director stood there chatting for a moment, a clipped conversation, one specialist to another. Tengo couldn't really follow their conversation. The two of them seemed to know each other. This was a small town. Probably everybody knew everybody else. Near the morgue was an inconspicuous back door, and the funeral parlor's small van was parked just outside. Except for the driver's window, all the windows were tinted black, and the jet-black van was devoid of any sign or markings. The thin funeral director and his white-haired assistant moved Tengo's father onto a rolling gurney and pushed it toward the van. The van had been refitted to have an especially high ceiling and rails onto which they slid the body. They shut the back doors of the van with an earnest thud. The funeral director turned to Tengo and bowed, and the van pulled away. Tengo, the lawyer, Nurse Tamura, and Nurse Omura all faced the rear door of the black Toyota van and brought their hands together in prayer. Tengo and the lawyer talked in a corner of the cafeteria. The lawyer looked to be in his mid-40s and was quite obese, the exact opposite of the funeral director. His chin had nearly disappeared, and despite the chill of winter, his forehead was covered with a light sheen of sweat. He must sweat something awful in the summer, Tengo thought. His gray wool suit smelled of mothballs. He had a narrow forehead, and above it an overabundance of thick, luxurious black hair. The combination of the obese body and the thick hair didn't work. His eyelids were heavy and swollen, his eyes narrow, but behind them was a friendly glint.
"Your father entrusted me with his will. The word will implies something significant, but this isn't like one of those wills from a detective novel," the lawyer said, and cleared his throat. "It's actually closer to a simple memo. Let me start by briefly summarizing its contents. The will begins by outlining arrangements for his funeral. I believe the gentleman from Zenkosha has explained this to you?"
"Yes, he did. It's to be a simple funeral."
"Very good," the lawyer said. "That was your father's wish, that everything be done as plainly as possible. The funeral expenses will be paid out of a reserve fund he set aside, and medical and other expenses will come out of the security deposit your father paid when he checked into this facility. There will be nothing you will have to pay for out of your own pocket."
"He didn't want to owe anybody anything, did he?"
"Exactly. Everything has been prepaid. Also, your father has money in an account at the Chikura post office, which you, as his son, will inherit. You will need to take care of changing it over to your name. To do that, you'll need the proof that your father has been removed from the family register and a copy of your family register and seal certificate. You should go directly to the Chikura post office and sign the necessary documents yourself. The procedures take some time. As you know, Japanese banks and the post office are quite particular about filling in all the proper forms." The lawyer took a large white handkerchief out of his coat pocket and wiped the sweat from his forehead.
"That's all I need to tell you about the inheritance. He had no assets other than the post office account. No insurance policies, stocks, real estate, jewelry, art objects, nothing of this sort. Very straightforward, you could say, and fuss-free."
Tengo nodded silently. It sounded like his father. But taking over his postal account made Tengo feel a little depressed. It felt like being handed a pile of damp, heavy blankets. If possible, he would rather not have it. But he couldn't say this.
"Your father also entrusted an envelope to my care. I have brought it with me and would like to give it to you now."
The thick brown envelope was sealed tight with packing tape. The obese lawyer took it from his black briefcase and laid it on the table.
"I met Mr. Kawana soon after he came here, and he gave this to me then. He was still conscious then. He would get confused occasionally, but he was generally able to function fine. He told me that when he died, he would like me to give this envelope to his legal heir."
"Legal heir?" Tengo repeated, a bit surprised.
"Yes, that was the term he used. Your father didn't specify anyone in particular, but in practical terms, you would be the only legal heir."
"As far as I know."
"Then, as instructed, here you go," the lawyer said, pointing to the envelope on the table. "Could you sign a receipt for it, please?"
Tengo signed the receipt. The brown office envelope on the table looked anonymous and bland. Nothing was written on it, neither on the front nor on the back.
"There's one thing I would like to ask you," Tengo said to the lawyer. "Did my father ever mention my name, or use the word son?"
As he mulled this over, the lawyer pulled out his handkerchief again and mopped his brow. He shook his head slightly.
"No, Mr. Kawana always used the term legal heir. He didn't use any other terms. I remember this because I found it odd."
Tengo was silent. The lawyer collected himself and spoke up.
"But you have to understand that Mr. Kawana knew you were the only legal heir. It's just that when we spoke, he didn't use your name. Does that bother you?"
"Not really," Tengo said. "My father was always a bit odd." The lawyer smiled as if relieved and gave a slight nod. He handed Tengo a new copy of their family register.
"If you don't mind, since it was this sort of illness, I would like you to check the family register so we can make sure there are no legal problems with the procedure. According to the record, you are Mr. Kawana's sole child. Your mother passed away a year and a half after giving birth to you. Your father didn't remarry and raised you by himself. Your father's parents and siblings are already deceased. So, you are clearly Mr. Kawana's sole legal heir. After the lawyer stood up, expressed his condolences, and left, Tengo remained seated, gazing at the envelope on the table. His father was his real blood father, and his mother was really dead. The lawyer had said so. So it must be true, or at least a fact in a legal sense. But it felt like the more facts that were revealed, the more the truth receded. Why would that be? Tengo returned to his father's room, sat down at the desk, and struggled to open the sealed envelope. The envelope might contain the key to unlocking some mystery. Opening it was difficult. There were no scissors or box cutters in the room, so he had to peel off the packing tape with his fingernails. When he finally managed to get the envelope open, the contents were in several other envelopes, all of them in turn tightly sealed. Just the sort of thing he expected from his father. One envelope contained 500,000 yen in cash, exactly 50 crisp new 10,000 yen bills wrapped in layers of thin paper. A piece of paper included with it said, "Emergency cash." Definitely his father's writing, small letters, nothing abbreviated. This money must be in case there were unanticipated expenses. His father had anticipated that his legal heir wouldn't have sufficient funds on hand. The thickest of the envelopes was stuffed full of newspaper clippings and various award certificates, all of them about Tengo. His certificate from when he won the math contest in elementary school, and the article about it in the local paper. A photo of Tengo next to his trophy. The artistic-looking award Tengo received for having the best grades in his class. He had the best grades in every subject. There were various other articles that showed what a child prodigy Tengo had been. A photo of Tengo in a judo gi in junior high, grinning, holding the second-place banner. Tengo was really surprised to see these. After his father had retired from NHK, he left the company housing he had been in, moved to another apartment in Ichikawa, and finally went to the sanatorium in Chikura. Probably because he had moved by himself so often, he had hardly any possessions, and father and son had basically been strangers to each other for years. Despite this, his father had lovingly carried around all these mementos of Tengo's child prodigy days. The next envelope contained various records from his father's days as an NHK fee collector. A record of the times when he was the top producer of the year. Several simple certificates. A photo apparently taken with a colleague on a company trip. An old ID card. Records of payment to his retirement plan and health insurance. Though his father worked like a dog for NHK for over 30 years, the amount of material left was surprisingly little. Next to nothing when compared with Tengo's achievements in elementary school. Society might see his father's entire life as amounting to almost zero, but to Tengo it wasn't next to nothing. Along with a postal savings book, his father had left behind a deep, dark shadow. There was nothing in the envelope to indicate anything about his father's life before he joined NHK. It was as if his father's life began the moment he became an NHK fee collector. He opened the final envelope, a thin one, and found a single black-and-white photograph. That was all. It was an old photo, and though the contrast hadn't faded, there was a thin membrane over the whole picture, as if water had seeped into it. It was a photo of a family, a father, a mother, and a tiny baby. The baby looked less than a year old. The mother, dressed in a kimono, was lovingly cradling the baby. Behind them was a torii gate at a shrine. From the clothes they had on, it looked like winter. Since they were visiting a shrine, it was most likely New Year's. The mother was squinting as if the light were too bright, and smiling. The father, dressed in a dark coat slightly too big for him, had frown lines between his eyes, as if to say he didn't take anything at face value. The baby looked confused by how big and cold the world could be. The young father in the photo had to be Tengo's father. He looked much younger, though he had already had a sort of surprising maturity about him, and he was thin, his eyes sunken. It was the face of a poor farmer from some out-of-the-way hamlet, stubborn, skeptical. His hair was cut short, his shoulders a bit stooped. That could only be his father. This meant that the baby must be Tengo,
and the mother holding the baby must be Tengo's mother. His mother was slightly taller than his father and had good posture. His father was in his late 30s, while his mother looked to be in her mid-20s. Tengo had never seen the photograph before. He had never seen anything that could be called a family photo, and he had never seen a picture of himself when he was little. They couldn't afford a camera, his father had once explained, and never had the opportunity to take any family photos. And Tengo had accepted this. But now he knew it was a lie. They had taken a photo together, and though their clothes weren't exactly luxurious, they were at least presentable. They didn't look as if they were so poor they couldn't afford a camera. The photo was taken not long after Tengo was born, sometime between 1954 and 1955. He turned the photo over, but there was no date or indication of where it had been taken. Tengo studied the woman. In the photo, her face was small and slightly out of focus. If only he had a magnifying glass. Then he could have made out more details. Still, he could see most of her features. She had an oval-shaped face, a small nose, and plump lips. By no means a beauty, though sort of cute, the type of face that left a good impression. At least compared with his father's rustic face, she looked far more refined and intelligent. Tengo was happy about this. Her hair was nicely styled, but since she had on a kimono, he couldn't tell much about her figure. At least as far as they looked in this photo, no one could call them a well-matched couple. There was a great age difference between them. Tengo tried to imagine his parents meeting each other, falling in love, having him, but he just couldn't see it. You didn't get that sense at all from the photo. So if there wasn't an emotional attachment that brought them together, there must have been some other circumstances that did. No, maybe it wasn't as dramatic as the term circumstances made it sound. Life might just be an absurd, even crude chain of events, and nothing more. Tengo tried to figure out if the mother in this photo was the mysterious woman who appeared in his daydreams, or in his fog of childhood memories, but he realized he didn't have any memories of the woman's face whatsoever. The woman in his memory took off her blouse, let down the straps of her slip, and let some unknown man suck her breasts, and her breathing became deeper, like she was moaning. That's all he remembered, some man sucking his mother's breasts. The breasts that should have been his alone were stolen away by somebody else. A baby would no doubt see this as a grave threat. His eyes never went to the man's face. Tengo returned the photo to the envelope and thought about what it meant. His father had cherished this one photograph until he died, which might mean he still cherished Tengo's mother. Tengo couldn't remember his mother, for she had died from illness when he was too young to have any memories of her. According to the lawyer's investigation, Tengo was the only child of his mother and his father, the NHK fee collector, a fact recorded in his family register. But official documents didn't guarantee that that man was Tengo's biological father. "I don't have a son," his father had declared to Tengo before he fell into a coma. "So what am I?" Tengo had asked. "You're nothing," was his father's concise and peremptory reply. His father's tone of voice had convinced Tengo that there was no blood connection between him and this man, and he had felt freed from heavy shackles. As time went on, however, he wasn't completely convinced that what his father had said was true. "I'm nothing," Tengo repeated. Suddenly he realized that his young mother in the photo from long ago reminded him of his older girlfriend. Kyoko Yasuda was her name. In order to calm his mind, he pressed his fingers hard against the middle of his forehead. He took the photo out again and stared at it. A small nose, plump lips, a somewhat pointed chin. Her hairstyle was so different he hadn't noticed at first, but her features did somewhat resemble Kyoko's. But what could that possibly mean? And why did his father think to give this photo to Tengo after his death? While he was alive, he had never provided Tengo with a single piece of information about his mother. He had even hidden the existence of this family photo. One thing Tengo did know was that his father never intended to explain the situation to him, not while he was alive, and not even now after his death. "Look, here's a photo," his father must be saying. "I'll just hand it to you. It's up to you to figure it out." Tengo lay face up on the bare mattress and stared at the ceiling.
It was a painted white plywood ceiling, flat, with no wood grain or knots, just several straight joints where the boards came together, the same scene his father's sunken eyes must have viewed during the last few months of life. Or maybe those eyes didn't see anything.